Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We've got a really special show for you this afternoon, I'm happy to say, as we sit here live in the Political Rewind studio in Midtown Atlanta, GPB in Midtown Atlanta. Our special guest is Speaker of the Georgia House, David Ralston, and we're so happy you could be here, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Bill.
And joining me to quiz you, ask you for a conversation, let's do it that way, is Greg Bluestein, who I think, I never call you this, but you're essentially the lead political reporter at the AJC. I mean, your byline is everywhere all the time.
It is a good time to be a political reporter in Georgia.
Absolutely. The nice thing for you, Mr. Speaker, I suspect, is that if Bluestein is like I am, I've had about 3 hours sleep after watching the Alabama Senate race last night.
I am running on fumes.
And let me, before we get into our conversation with the Speaker about the legislative session upcoming, a couple of quick headlines. Rod Rosenstein is on Capitol Hill today, the Deputy Attorney General. He has been getting quizzed closely about the questions as to whether Robert Mueller's investigation is now under, should be under a cloud of scrutiny because of text messages from a couple of the, from the lead investigator on the Hillary Clinton case and then on the Trump case. Indicating his bias against Donald Trump, Rosenstein, just the headline is, has told members up on the Hill that he has seen nothing that indicates that there's anything corrupted at all about the Mueller investigation. But that's a story we'll be following in the days ahead because it's an important one. And second, it appears that Republicans in the House and Senate are getting closer and closer to reaching a deal on the tax overhaul, and that they may be calling for a vote in both the House and the Senate by next week, which is what the president has said all along he wants. The biggest piece that fell into place is there was the issue about state and local tax deductions, whether or not they would be lost. That was a big bone of contention, especially members from high tax states, California, New York, for instance. So now they've got a deal that you as a taxpayer could choose either a property tax deduction or a deduction for state and local income taxes up to $10,000, it appears. That may get somewhere. They're still tampering, though, or tinkering, I should say, with this question of what the corporate tax rate should be. Trump wanted it at 20%. So did big contributors to the Republican Party. It now looks like they might settle at 21% in an effort to keep the deficit somewhat subdued. So we'll watch and see if all of that happens. But those are the headlines. Mr. Speaker, the big story in politics today, and we can't not talk to you about it, is this stunning upset, Doug Jones beating Roy Moore in Alabama. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the people of Alabama are probably relieved today that that's all over. I can only imagine what it's been like to be over there and to be sort of caught up in that over the last several weeks. I was noticing this morning in something I was reading about these write-in votes, and the thought struck me that probably Doug Jones should be very thankful today that Nick Saban didn't get in that race. I'm not sure that it was a surprise. The polls were all over the place going in. But it's over, and he will be the U.S. Senator from Alabama for, I think, the next 2 years, and then they'll have a race for a full term.
Is it a relief for you as a Republican here in Georgia that you don't have to in any way be accountable to some extent for Roy Moore?
Well, it's just a relief to be here in Georgia, regardless of party. Alabama's been, this is not the first political turmoil they've experienced in the last year or so, you know, with the resignation of a sitting governor under threat of impeachment and the trial and conviction of a sitting Speaker of the House over there. So, and now this, I mean, it's been a tumultuous year or two over there. So I'm very happy that I'm a Georgian. You know, I know that we'll be sort of dissecting winners and losers out of this race for quite some time. And you know, I'll leave it to you professionals to decide who are the winners and losers. But it did occur to me that that one big loser, I really believe, is this fellow Steve Bannon, who has taken it upon himself to sort of remake the Republican Party. Nobody elected him to do that, frankly, and and he failed in Alabama, and so maybe we'll hear less of him going forward.
Speaker Alston, you've already seen this a little bit in the Georgia House races, where you see Democrats who rarely contested seats before challenge for them and win a few of them. Do you worry that this gives Democrats more confidence going into the 2018 midterm elections?
Well, I think that there's this intense feeling that many Democrats have about the president that's driving turnout, probably to a greater extent than the intense feeling that many Republicans had about President Obama drove Republican turnout during the 8 years that he was president. So I think there is, I think as Republicans we would be kidding ourselves if we said there was not a good bit of energy on the Democratic side at this time. But if you look at the House races, I mean, you know, we can spend all afternoon, which I know y'all don't have, and I would prefer not to, going through and analyzing each of those. And I think there were a couple of aberrations in those. For example, the two seats that were flipped in the Athens-Clark County area, if you look at the results there, a couple of things are very evident. One, there was a T-splost issue on the ballot in Athens-Clark County, which really drove turnout in that county. And then, frankly, Republican turnout was down. You know, we feel very optimistic that we'll get both of those seats back in a normal election cycle that we'll have in 2018. You know, I think we have to recognize there is a good bit of energy on the Democratic side right now.
I was intrigued, Greg. I think it's in an interview that the Speaker did with you after the elections that turned over two of those House seats to Democrats. One of your quotes is, you did say to Greg that you expected to get those seats back, and you said, while every race is important, only 1% of the seats in the House changed hands between parties. I'd caution against reading too much into such a minor shift. That's just going to energize Democrats even more, Mr. Speaker.
if they read what I say, or read what Greg writes that I say.
How do Republicans recapture some of that energy that we saw last year? What's on the agenda next year to do so?
Well, I think a couple of things. One depends to a great extent on what happens in Washington. I think that, as Bill mentioned in the lead to the program, all indications today are that the House and the Senate have reached an agreement, at least in principle, on tax reform. I think that you know, moving an agenda forward in a constructive way will obviously be a good messaging point for us coming out of Washington. You know, my focus is on Georgia, and I think that continuing to talk about and continuing to do the things that we're doing here, which are moving this state forward in a very positive, successful way. I think will serve us well, and will give Republicans a great message to talk about, and the energy to go out and deliver the message.
Mr. Speaker, why don't let's talk about the agenda in the upcoming session, if we can. And by the way, we're going to talk more about the Alabama Senate race a little later in the show. The Speaker will be with us for a good portion of the program. But later on, Greg, you and I will break down some of the data in that race in a very specific way. Mr. Speaker, let's start with just your current activities. You're coming back into our studios after a visit to Milledgeville, where you've continued to look at the key needs of rural Georgia, primarily infrastructure-related needs. What has that been all about, and where are you headed?
Well, yeah, you're right. I just I drove directly from the old state capitol in Milledgeville to your studio here, and we had a great meeting over there last night and today with the Rural Development Council. The Rural Development Council was a group that resulted from a couple of years' discussion that we had had in the House amongst some of the leadership of the House, looking at the fact that Georgia has been very successful in attracting new business and growing jobs, but it seemed to many of us that success was limited to the metro areas, primarily Metro Atlanta, and that, as I like to say, the bright light of economic growth was not shining on every corner of the state. And so, in fact, many areas of Georgia have experienced population decline, lack of access to quality health care, poor educational outcomes. And so we started looking at what we can do as a state to help create a climate that would help attract and retain businesses in those areas. So this council was formed last legislative session, and I gave them one charge, and that was to go all over this state, have meetings out in the rural areas of Georgia. They were prohibited from meeting at the state capitol here in Atlanta. And so they've done that. They've been to Tifton. They've been to Bainbridge. They've been to Toccoa. They've been to Ellijay, and they've been to Waycross, and so they're in Milledgeville today and many other stops, looking at a lot of things, looking at infrastructure, looking at access to health care, looking at education, looking at all of the things that sort of are the backbone of commerce in those areas. And they have engaged with local leaders, and we will be coming out over the next 2 or 3 weeks with some legislative proposals that we'll bring forward next session. I have to tell you, I don't think there's anything that I have been a part of in my legislative career that has excited me more than this initiative.
Really?
Really.
But you have some constraints, clearly. I mean, so for instance, health care, access to health care. Rural hospitals are struggling in part because of lack of help from the federal government in terms of grant programs to sustain them. Education, you've got limited funds in the state budget to do much about the schools. So seeing your legislative package is going to be particularly interesting, I would think, because you've got some significant obstacles, issues you can't control.
Well, I mean, we can't solve everything, but I think we have to learn to sort of think in a more creative way. Let's talk about rural hospitals a moment. I mean, it's been a big story in Georgia over the last three or four or five years about the closure of a number of rural hospitals. Mm-hmm. One of those hospitals was in my house district that closed. And I think that what, as a result of really looking at why those facilities closed and looking at what we can do differently, I think we're thinking, and this is just one idea that's out there, is we have to, I think, accept the fact that not every community in Georgia can sustain a 30 or 40 or 50 bed hospital. Mm. But maybe an idea that that I like a lot is what we call the micro hospital, which is a trauma center in these communities with a very small number of beds for overnight care or things of that sort. I think those are feasible, and that's one thing that we're looking at in terms of health care. Another really critical part, I think, of economic development in rural Georgia is making sure that we knock down all the barriers and make it more accessible to bringing high-speed broadband to those areas. That's a foundational part of economic development, I think, in rural Georgia, because that will relate to health care, education, business. And so I think you're going to see some legislative proposals addressing that. We're not going to solve everything this sure. coming session. And when we set the council up, we put it on a two-year lifespan so this group would have the adequate time to really address very, very serious issues. I mean, we've been, you can go back, and I know, Bill, you're like me, you've been around a while, and you remember back in the 1980s, we were talking about two Georgias.
Yeah.
And I'm frankly tired of talking about two Georgias. We're one state, and so I think we have to approach this issue that
Craig,
way.
Craig, can we let you jump in?
A few of the gubernatorial candidates have embraced some of these ideas. We've heard from several of the candidates about broadband and rural economic development. Are you satisfied with what you're hearing so far out of the gubernatorial candidates?
I haven't read very much of it. I get a lot of their campaign emails you know, I know there's a fair amount of rhetoric being given to the subject, but I haven't seen any detailed proposals yet, so I'm going to withhold judgment on that.
There are mounting concerns right now about the future of Plant Vogtle. You, if I remember correctly, you voted against that bill.
I did.
In 2009. Why'd you make
it? Wait, make sure that our listeners know what that bill was so they would make sure they know what the speaker was voting against.
It was a bill to allow, let me try to get this correct, Georgia Power to hike rates on consumers.
To let consumers share the costs of construction of Plant Vogtle, essentially. You voted no. Don't do that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Voted no. Narrowly passed both chambers. Why'd you make that decision back then? And do you worry lawmakers might have to step in next session as this debate continues?
Well, I voted no at that time because I thought it was bad public policy to have consumers, in effect, almost prepaying for that construction project. And I voted no because I was afraid we'd get to the point that we've gotten to. Now, having said that, we're way down the road. And so I'm not sure. I know that I've had discussions with the utility, and I know that they're committed to trying to turn this thing around. I want to work with them to the extent that we can, because you know, looking at the long view, we need that facility to come online. We need the power that will be generated by it, and so I'm not one of these that thinks that we should just you know, wash our hands of it and walk away.
So we know that there has been a study conducted with recommendations made that the project should not continue. By the way, we now expect PSC to make a decision about this, to announce it next week. And next Wednesday, Tim Echols, PSC Commissioner Tim Echols, will be in here the day before the PSC is supposed to act on this. Does that study though, give you concern? You are saying you believe they've gone so far. They've got to finish this.
A point of no return.
And consumers are inevitably going to have to pay more for the costs of all this.
What I'm saying is that we have we've gotten a long way down the road, and I'm not inclined to turn our back on the project until we've exhausted every conceivable way of salvaging it.
Let me change the subject, if I could. Excuse me. Obviously, the Me Too movement, sexual harassment, is gaining huge headlines these days. You now have created, it's a subcommittee, if I'm correct, of the, what group is it? Which committee is it?
The Legislative,
Legislative Services Committee. You've got a subcommittee, six members. Did you and the Lieutenant Governor each have the individual opportunity to name members to that committee? And I ask you that, you know why. You have Jan Jones in your body on that committee, but there's no woman from the Senate on it. And in fact, a group looking at sexual harassment under the Gold Dome has now one woman and five men.
Well, I'm the chair of that by law. The law creating the Legislative Services Committee was enacted in 1959. The Speaker of the House is the chair of that committee. It is the only committee that brings members of both the Senate and the House together to oversee the administration and operations of the General Assembly. I chair the committee. The Lieutenant Governor is a member. President pro tem, the Speaker pro tem, Senate President pro tem, and the House Speaker pro tem, and other designated committee chairs, and the majority leader of both chambers and the minority leaders of both chambers sit on the committee. So it occurred to me, and the Lieutenant Governor and I did have a conversation, and it occurred to me that we have in place now in the employee handbook for the entire General Assembly a zero tolerance provision sexual harassment and inappropriate conduct. You may remember in 2010, when I was first elected Speaker of the House adopted a rule that's in the House rules reiterating the zero tolerance policy, because I thought that at that time, in light of some things that had occurred prior to my becoming Speaker, that we needed to deal with that. So with the discussion that's going on now publicly about these issues, it occurred to me, Lieutenant Governor was in agreement, that we needed to look at both of those with people that are expert in the field. We have a brilliant attorney that's working with us, who, by the way, is female, and we brought in helping us look at that. So this subcommittee that I appointed is charged with reviewing what we have in place and seeing if it can be improved. And so when I appointed the subcommittee, I appointed the only female member of the Legislative Services Committee on that body.
And were you locked into that? I mean, because you understand
appearances. No, I appointed Jan Jones because she's a strong, good leader.
Should women be at all skeptical? Because there aren't at least a couple more women looking at that issue.
Well, the reason for that is I had no the Senate has no women in leadership positions.
Yeah, you know, somebody pointed that out. No, I'm not blaming you. I hope we're making that clear.
Yeah.
You have a woman from the House on that. And in fact, one of our panelists the other day made that point, that one of the issues, of course, here is that over on the Senate side, the choices among Republican women are very, very slim. So I'm not suggesting that you somehow, you've done your part. It just feels as if it would be nice to see another woman on the panel.
To answer your question, I will answer it both yes and no. I would say they should not be skeptical. I say that that answer is based on the fact that I know these individuals. I know them to be fair-minded. I know them to be committed to doing the right thing. If for people who do not know them, I could understand some skepticism.
Okay, fair enough. Greg?
Yeah, switching subjects a little bit. Should local governments have a say in whether Civil War monuments be housed in their communities?
You know, the history of Georgia is a history that we share as a state. I think in another forum we talked about this recently. The history of Georgia is the same whether you live in Blue Ridge, Bainbridge, or Decatur. It's all the same history. And I think that to allow local communities to decide what they're going to honor or dishonor, I don't know how that brings us together as a state, frankly. You know, it's all it's the same history. Is it all positive? No. We know that. I mean, we share with other states some dark chapters in our history as a state. What I would prefer to see our discussion about is how we can learn from that history and how we can move forward. You know, it's not that many generations back that Georgia was largely an agrarian state. We've come a long way. We're now a world-class state. We've hosted the Olympics. We've hosted the Super Bowl, I think, on one occasion, maybe twice. I mean, we got major corporations that are coming here to do business and employ people. That's the kind of future I want us to talk about.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. If you want to finish that thought,
Greg, we're having the national championship game here on the evening of January 8th, where a Georgia football team will become the national champion.
I'm holding you to that.
Promise.
Greg Bluestein being one of the two, along with Brian Robinson, one of the two total Bulldog fans who participate in Political Rewind. So in regard to that, Mr. Speaker, do you see a distinction between the so-called lost cause monuments, like the one in the Decatur Square, which seemed to celebrate the cause of the Confederacy, as opposed to, say, a marker, say, at the Kennesaw Battlefield, which specifically is a historic, you're a great student of history. Is there a difference between those two, and should legislators weigh them differently?
You know, markers are put up for all kinds of reasons. I frankly don't know the history of the one on the Decatur Square. Is it different than a battlefield? Sure it is. You know what we have in downtown Blue Ridge? We have a historical marker honoring a Union sympathizer who was assassinated in the mountains of North Georgia end of the Civil War.
We have made note on this show on numerous occasions of the fact that your people were up there in Union County and were on the Union side.
There's a reason
it was
called Union County, right?
Not Union, actually. It was Gilmer and Fannin.
Okay.
But we digress. So markers are out there to because they were. Somebody thought at some point in time that they should be put there. And I didn't hear any discussion about the Decatur monument or statue or until this summer. I think it's been there a long time. I just think that, you know, as I go back to my point, as a state, we share a history. That is part of what makes us the state of Georgia. Bad, and ugly.
Could we take 2 more minutes of your time?
Sure.
Thank you.
What, if anything, will Georgia lawmakers be doing next year to give the state a leg up on the competition for Amazon? And does the political turmoil in Alabama, does that help Georgia's case? Does it have any bearing on Georgia's case for Amazon?
I think we'll make our case on our own merits. I don't know. I don't want to speak to Alabama's prospects. I know there are other states in the running, from what I hear. I think that we will continue to look for ways to create a climate that's pro-business, pro-job growth, by looking at ways that we can lessen the tax burden on small business, look at ways that we can ease up on the regulatory environment, and welcome these businesses here, as we have with Mercedes-Benz, and as we have with State Farm and Kia and all the others that have come here. I think we're going to be competitive.
You, of course, part of that issue is deals with the certain reintroduction again of a religious liberty measure, which you have always worked very hard to keep from being passed, at least in the form that you have found unappealing. You were over talking to our friend Dennis O'Hare, and he asked you about that. You said, I frankly don't intend to spend a lot of time on that issue as we go into the next session. Clearly, it's going to come back. It'll start in the Senate again, we presume, right?
I don't know what the Senate's going to do. The Senate's got a bill over there that I hope they're going to take up and pass early in the session that I think really matters to the least among us, and that's children in foster care. A 2-year bill that we passed unanimously twice last session that would modernize our adoption code in Georgia, eliminate barriers and obstacles to adoptions, speed up the adoption process so that we can get kids out of foster homes and into permanent, stable, loving environments. And we passed it and sent it over there, and then they want to inject this issue in that. To me, is you know, I can't even kind of wrap my brain around why, because now we've had a whole year go by, we haven't changed our adoption law, and the only people hurting from that are children in foster care.
Yeah, great. Go ahead.
And so. That's what I'm hoping they will do. Now, I don't know what else they're going to introduce. I got a lot of things on my plate. We're going to talk about rural development. We're going to talk about transit. We're going to talk about balancing the budget. We're going to hopefully talk about some state tax reform. We passed a bill last year, sent it to the Senate, and never saw it again. So those are the things that I think Georgians want us focused on. And that's what I'm focused on.
All right. We have to let you go because we promised we wouldn't hold you for too long. You're very busy as you get set for the session. But it's really terrific to have you come in and talk with us. You've got an exciting and challenging session ahead, especially with the gubernatorial candidates lined up under the Gold Dome, whether that's the lieutenant governor, the secretary of state, or the others you're going to have to deal with. And, of course, you've got your own legislative races ahead of you. We will, of course, be following all of that on Political Rewind in the months ahead. But thank you so much for being with us,
Thank
Mr.
you very
Speaker.
Much.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Greg Bluestein and I will hold down the fort, and let's talk, Greg, about this Alabama Senate race and how things unfolded the way they did.
I'm game.
You're listening to Political Rewind.
You count on GPB to bring you reporting that helps you better understand our world. And as 2017 comes to a close, we're counting on you. Listeners make the independent journalism and all the programs that you hear possible. As you support the organizations that matter to you, please remember how much you rely on GPB. Go to gpb.org and click donate to make your tax-deductible year-end gift. And thanks so much for your support.
On the next Fresh Air, infidelity. Why do people cheat? Does it count as cheating when your spouse no longer knows your name because they have Alzheimer's? Is looking at pornography cheating? We speak with psychotherapist Esther Perel about her work with couples dealing with infidelity. Her new book is called The State of Affairs. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We again appreciate having Speaker Ralston here. You know, it seems to me, Greg, he's really got his job cut out for him this year. For instance, religious liberty is one example. You now have four gubernatorial candidates who have all signed a pledge that they will, if they become governor, work toward a religious liberty. They'll sign a religious liberty bill. Does that take him off the hook for this session, or is it going to mean the pressure will be there to get it done even sooner?
I think most Republicans are hoping that the Supreme Court handles this for them, right? Yeah. The Supreme Court took up that issue last week, and their ruling is expected sometime next year. And so there's a hope that that takes the issue off the table. But I will say that one candidate, Clay Tippins, he's a Republican businessman, first time running for office, he's the one who did not sign that pledge. So that might be a wedge issue that he could gain some support with, I think.
Yeah. It. You know, the other thing that we didn't talk about, because the speaker's not going to talk about this, is, of course, right now, the presumed front runner in the Republican gubernatorial race is the lieutenant governor. In the best of years, the Senate and the House, and we heard a little of it here, are at odds with one another, don't have the best relationships. Are you expecting that that's going to get particularly thorny this year?
Yeah, you know, he had an interesting answer when we asked him whether or not, you know, he's hearing what he wants to hear from the gubernatorial candidates. He basically said, I'm not really paying that much attention to the gubernatorial candidates. I'm not really reading their rhetoric. I'm not looking at their plans. So that says a lot. And remember, we're going into a year with all these elections, but after those elections, the speaker will be the last of those three sort of Georgia pillars standing. There'll be a new governor and there'll be a new lieutenant governor. And we've asked him before about why he's not taking a plunge, either running for higher office or calling it quits. He said, you know, I kind of want to be the guy who sticks around for this and helps, you know, helps smooth the transition for when there is a new governor and lieutenant governor.
Well, all right. It was great to have him here, and there's a lot more we could talk about, and we'll get a chance to talk to him again, obviously, as the session unfolds. So let's go back to the Alabama Senate race and dig in a little deeper. The first thing that I'd like to point out, and then I'll be interested in your more general observations, whatever you really want to address in terms of, excuse me, as we look at the vote totals, we now know for certain what we suspected last night. And that is, let me just give you some numbers. Doug Jones beat Roy Moore by 20,715 votes. That's a huge margin for a Democrat to get in the state of Alabama. I've had people say to me today, well, it wasn't much of a, you know, a victory. Are you kidding? In Alabama, that's staggering.
A state that Donald Trump won by nearly 30%
yes.
of the vote.
But the write-in votes account, 22,819 people wrote in another candidate. So Doug Jones won on the strength of disaffected Republicans who preferred to write in Nick Saban, presumably, and others. I haven't seen all of the other names that were written in. But if it had not been for those write-in votes, We might very well be talking about Roy Moore as the next United States
Senator. I think you're exactly right.
Alabama. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And of course, those write-in votes are largely from Republicans who couldn't stomach either voting for Jones or Roy Moore. There was actually a write-in candidate as well. He was a retired military officer who might be getting some of those. But I think there'll be a lot of Nick Saban's, Pinocchio's, Mickey Mouse's from Republicans who wanted to vote, who wanted to show up and vote. And not sort of, you know, betray their sense of duty voting, but also just couldn't vote for Roy Moore.
You were over in Alabama, spent some time over there. As you talk to voters, no one anticipated this outcome, so I don't want to make you seem prescient in a way that wouldn't be fair to suggest you are. But could you sense doubts? Could you sense the possibility that Republicans were not enthused about Roy Moore?
Yeah, I mean, I targeted two areas. I went to the suburban areas that full of mostly white voters that the Doug Jones campaign was hoping to flip. And I went to rural areas that Donald Trump won by, I'm talking 90% of the vote, huge margins, to see the depth of support for Roy Moore there. And among Democrats, or among newly turned Democrats, I talked to people who had never voted for a Democrat in their lifetimes but were voting for Doug Jones. There was a lot of pessimism. There was this sort of, you know, I'm doing this, but I don't think he has any chance in winning. And among the Republicans I talked to, I went to Cleburne County, which was one of those counties. Roy Moore actually won that county by 80%. Trump won it by 90%. But there was a lot of, oh, there's no chance. There's no way Roy Moore loses this. And so there was this, you saw the confidence on the Republican side and you know, the skepticism on the Democratic side. Turns out, you know, Democrats showed up big. The massive turnout in the metro areas too, Birmingham, Huntsville, Montgomery. I mean, Doug Jones won almost 70% of Jefferson County, which houses Birmingham and a lot of the wealthier enclaves.
Huge. Yeah. On the morning of the election and in the days leading up to it, all of the prognosticators were suggesting that it would be a big deal if Doug Jones could get 25% African American turnout to vote for him. And that still wouldn't be enough to put him over. He would still going to need those white suburban voters primarily. Almost 30% of the vote, African American voters. That's staggering.
It is, and black women were the story. 17% of the entire electorate were black, according to exit polls, were African American women, and of those, 98%. Back Doug Jones. So basically monolithic support among black women for Doug Jones. And that's why Georgia Democrats are getting a little bit more excited today, because African-American women are the most significant voting bloc for Georgia Democrats. Stacey Abrams is running to be the first African-American woman as governor in the nation's history. And so she's saying, and her camp is saying, look, if Doug Jones can do this in Alabama by exciting the base and getting African-Americans who typically don't show up on non-presidential years to show up in an election like this across the state lines, imagine what can happen in Georgia.
Well, yes, of course, and that's a perfectly reasonable thing if you're in the Abrams camp to want to talk about. It seems to me, at the same moment, if white suburban women turned out in bigger numbers than expected, those who might have been Republicans previously, to vote for the Democrat, does that give Stacey Evans any hope? Or do you imagine that those Republican women are going to stick with a Republican candidate here in Georgia?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly Stacey Evans' is campaign strategy. And
they both got something out of this race, in other words.
You're right. They both did. I mean, if you look at the suburbs of Mountain Brook, or Vestavia Hills, or some of these other suburbs that were long Republican strongholds, they weren't. I mean, I drove all through a lot of those suburbs just a few weeks ago, and Doug Jones signs had sprouted like mushrooms all across those areas. And I'd go interview folks who in those houses, and they say, "Yeah, we've never put a sign up for anyone, let alone a Democrat, but now we are."
Okay, having said all of that, do we also have to acknowledge that Roy Moore was an outlier? This is a guy that if I were a Democrat, I'd look for victory everywhere I can in this. I'd look, if I were Abrams and Evans, for ways to suggest that now my chances are increased. But this was Roy Moore. This wasn't you know, a stand-up, mm-hmm. straight Republican candidate. This was a guy with so much baggage that the question becomes, can we really draw significant insight about how things might happen moving forward?
Exactly. And today, Republicans are saying that this proves, again, the maxim that we all know in politics, candidates matter. And when you have a candidate like Roy Moore, who's been accused of being a child predator on the ballot, who by the way, had always struggled more than other Republicans in Alabama races. He ran for governor twice, lost. In his two state Supreme Court victories, he underperformed other Republicans on the ballot. In 2012, he only beat a Democrat by 4 points. And this is in a state that hadn't had a Democrat win a major statewide victory in nearly 20 years.
Yeah.
So he'd always struggled, and he was struggling even before this because of other controversial statements he's made in his past. But I think that the allegations really pivoted this race and encouraged folks who just were on the fence to say, I'm either staying home, voting for Jones, or writing in a candidate.
Right, so we talked earlier with the speaker about the fact that, before the speaker began, I read a headline about the fact it looks like the House and the Senate are getting closer on the tax bill. They hope to vote next week in both bodies to finally pass one of the first legislative package that the president has been behind. And Mitch McConnell has made it clear, and he made this clear before the votes started coming in. The majority leader's office announced that they will not seat the new senator from Alabama until after the first of the year. You've got to wonder whether he's got smart, smart political people working with him, whether they sent something in the wind for Doug Jones, or whether they just figured Luther Strange is already a sure bet in their favor on the tax package. Whatever the reason, the majority leader is now under some pressure to seat Doug Jones as quickly as possible. He's not going to do that.
No. And going into this race, this was already a loss for the establishment Republicans, right? This was, no matter who won, this was going to be a devastating defeat for them. And there was a debate whether or not they were going to pursue an ethics charge against Roy Moore once he did get seated. So there was already that underlying it. But no, Luther Strange is going to be a yes vote for this tax bill.
Absolutely. So he'll be there voting for it.
He will. And they have to now they really have a timetable, you know, because in about a month, there will be one vote Republican edge there. And so very little breathing room for any major bill.
Yeah. Do you happen to know what controls how quickly a incoming member has to be seated? Is there a time frame? I'm not aware of it.
I'd love
if there's somebody out there who knows. Tweet us and let us know. Here's Mitch McConnell resisted all the pressure in the world to not go ahead with a confirmation hearing on an Obama Supreme Court nominee for a year waiting for a Republican president. He's certainly not going to be swayed by a little pressure right now to get Doug Jones seated anytime soon. But I wonder if there's a certain point at which he has to.
Yeah, I know that the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader have some sort of leverage on how quickly it gets done. But I also know they can't drag their feet forever. While they have the vote, you know, while they have Luther Strange, who is a reliable Republican vote, who I don't think has bucked the party line too much since he got that post, they're going to keep him.
President Trump this morning claimed his own personal victory. He tweeted that, hey, I knew all along that Roy Moore couldn't possibly win, which is why I backed Luther Strange the first time out. How damaged do you believe? Where does the president stand? I mean, the president now, he lost in Virginia. He lost in the Alabama, the first round with Luther Strange. He loses with Roy Moore. And yet, going into the 2018 cycle, an incumbent Republican would probably be crazy to not want the president to be there for him. Yeah,
and think about it. He's only in this position because he put Jeff Sessions as his attorney general, and Jeff Sessions has been giving him a lot of headaches since doing that. And he's you know, there's always rumors that Jeff Sessions isn't long for that job in the first place. It's a test of Trump's base, and it shows that the base, and this is one of the first races that really shows that, because in other races, like the one in Georgia for the 6th District, like other races in Montana and in South Carolina, special House elections. Republicans did win on the strength of the Republican DNA in those districts. In this race, the Republican DNA deeply rooted in Alabama was not enough. So it shows that his base alone, you know, might do it in some districts in some states, but in statewide election like Alabama, it didn't do it.
Were you as surprised as I was by exit polling data which showed that the president's approval rating was split in Alabama?
And it was sub 50.
49-49.
Yeah, I was.
I was astonished by that.
Yeah, and the 49% who approved him were fervent Republicans who are reliable votes. But the fact that that he did not have a majority of support in Alabama, a state, again, that he won by 27-28 points, shocking.
All right, let me bring this back to Georgia and see if we can draw any comparisons. So Steve Bannon, of course, went all in with for Roy Moore, went in a couple times, made campaign speeches that struck me as being kind of pure ego, just him getting a chance to get up there and talk. Blab. So we have a gubernatorial candidate here in Georgia, Michael Williams, who at least early on seems to feel that adopting that kind of Trump persona, making more provocative, bold statements, has a campaign manager who seems to encourage that sort of thing.
Was a former Trump campaign manager.
Former Trump guy, right, Seth Weathers. What do you think about the possibility that looking at what happened, Steve Bannon got nowhere, President Trump got nowhere with Roy Moore, do you imagine there's going to be any moderation in that campaign because of that? Are they going to say, whoa, maybe we better put on the brakes on trying to be the most provocative, making the most outrageous statements that'll get media attention?
Yeah, for Michael Williams, I don't think so. And look, if you look at his response to the wave of Democratic elections in November in Virginia, his statement says, oh well, you know, that it's because Republicans didn't nominate the pro-Trump guy. They nominated Ed Gillespie instead. His response to last night was, oh, it's not because they didn't nominate the pro-Trump guy. It's because the establishment did everything they could to secretly, he used the word secretly, fight back against Roy Moore. You have seen moderation among the messages of some of the other candidates. When pressed on it, Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle and former State Senator Hunter Hill, both candidates for governor, did not embrace Roy Moore
right,
at all.
Right. All right. Last night was one of those nights when we love being political journalists, don't we?
Christmas and Hanukkah rolled together.
All rolled together in one. Greg Bluestein, we're out of time, but I really appreciate your being here today. Tomorrow, Two-Way Street, Christian Bush of Sugarland. They're back together. Christian plays his Christmas music for us, talks about his life. It's, I think, a really fun show. I hope you'll tune in at 2 o'clock for Two-Way Street. Then Friday, among others, Teresa Tomlinson, the mayor of Columbus, will be back up here. She's a Democrat. Can't wait to hear how she assesses what happened in Alabama yesterday. Heath Garrett, Republican, will be here. And Michael Owens, the chair of the Cobb County Democratic Party. So that's a good lineup, too. So that's it for us for today. Thanks for being with us for Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. See you tomorrow for Two-Way Street and Friday at 3 for Political Rewind.